I believe some of those prayers were, oh, Lord, please don't let them be too long. That's a pretty intense bit of scripture, isn't it? We'll see. Once upon a time, now all good stories, all good parables, they all begin that way. Once upon a time, there were two old men, lived together for many, many years, and in all that time, they had never quarreled. They had never fought over anything, never even had a disagreement. So one day, one of them said, do you suppose maybe we should try to have a quarrel at least once just to see what it's like? Well, maybe, said the other, but I don't really know how a quarrel works. Well, look, he says, I'll take a brick and put it between us, and I'll say, this is mine, and you say, no, it's mine, and after that, the quarrel begins. So they found a brick, put it between the two of them, and one of them said, this is mine. The other said, no, it's mine. And the first one said, okay, it's yours. And they went away unable to fight with one another and never thought about having a quarrel again. Now, the focus of this week's gospel story is a problem a lot of us would like to have to do, but we have to do with it too much. It is a story about a man who is so rich he doesn't know what to do with all of his possessions. Did anybody go to the grocery store yesterday? Yeah, did you see the line? I forgot about it, but I just had to go and buy some onions or something. And I went by, and the lottery line at Publix was wrapped around. So everybody getting their lottery tickets. And unfortunately for us, somebody in Chicago, and I went to Chicago last week, by the way, did not buy a lottery ticket there. I wished that I had, just so I could say, well, I know somebody who bought one in there. But anyway. So there's somebody up in Chicago who is very, very rich, has more than they know what to do with now. I just wonder how their life is going to change. But our passage begins with, quote, someone in the crowd asking Jesus to intervene in an inheritance matter within a family. Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me. Now, the commentaries offer a lot of speculation about this situation. Perhaps this was the younger brother, and he's unhappy about the division of the property of his father's after his father's death. The custom was for the older brother to get 2/3 of the property, and the younger brother would only get 1/3. And maybe he thought that that wasn't quite fair with the division. And I find it interesting and quite frankly insightful that Luke sets this story in a context where Jesus is approached by someone who's concerned about a family inheritance is to be divided, one who wants to make sure that they get their fair share. Is there any of us here who doesn't know this story? Now, in some way, in some context, the problem of someone wanting to make sure they get what is rightly theirs? Now, I know all of you at one time were children. Yes, you remember growing up. It's not fair, remember? No matter what it was, you would complain to mom and dad was, that's not fair. My mom actually had a micrometer. By the time I got into junior high, I knew how to use it because we measured pie with a micrometer. Who gets the biggest piece? And we would measure it out. My brother and I would... You know, make sure I got mine, because you know why? It's not fair. Life is supposed to be fair, right? And does mom and dad ever say that? No. They say life's not fair. Sorry. Mom, that's not fair. Life's not fair. Thanks, mom. Appreciate it. You know, it's great. Great philosophy. All because we begin to assume that what is essentially a gift is something that is ours. The things that come into our lives we feel we own. Without a reference to anybody else, without regard for other human need, our stuff is our stuff. But there's another way. And it is the only way by which both creation and God are honored, and that is to recognize that there is no mine or yours any more than there is just you or just me. We live in a community. We live in hope that to survive as a species, we learn to belong to one another. We learn to share. And when that happens, not by seeing how much we can continue to store up for ourselves and ourselves alone, but how we can distribute the abundance that which we have been blessed to others in our community, others around us. And if that sounds kind of radical, then you are hearing the scriptures clearly, because in God's domain, both the one that is now and the one that is to come, there is no argument over what belongs to whom, because it all belongs to God. And at any rate, Jesus flatly refuses to get involved in the matter. He rejects the request because he will not participate in satisfying the greed that he senses has prompted it. Friend, who set me to be a judge between you? But then, as Jesus so often did, he went right to the heart of the matter. Take care, he says. Take care and be on your guard against all kinds of greed, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. That is a powerful, surprising, and somewhat disappointing line, isn't it? Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. Why are we working so hard for all of that then? In a world like ours, this is a hard lesson to learn. A couple of years ago, the ABC News presented a special on greed, and the reporter, John Stossel, was there. He does amazing work. And he began with a look at the largest houses in America. And he went to one that was very close to me, right up in North Carolina, the Biltmore Estate. And so how many of you been to the Biltmore? Yeah, pretty cool place, right? And Stossel pointed out that the house is really gargantuan, 250 rooms, yet it's built, really, for just one man. The dining room is as high as a five-story building. The dining table sits how many people? How many do you have at Thanksgiving at your house? Well, apparently he had 64, because that's how many people it could sit. The reporter said, "I guess when you're rich, you make a lot of friends pretty easily. And from here, you can take in the millions of dollars of art on the walls, Renoirs and Whistlers, Renaissance tapestries. Very beautiful, but isn't it greedy? Who needs a $100 million house?" And just this week, I was watching television, and it was a story about money in America. And the Biltmore house doesn't even register anymore. Anybody have any idea how big the Hearst Mansion is? Mind-boggling. And people that have so much money, they don't know what to do with it. And so now, rather than building things, our billionaires are shooting themselves into space. There's a space race among the top 3 billionaires in the world to see who can get higher, faster, and longer. And, I mean, does that boggle your mind that that's where we're spending our money? Yeah, I just think it's a bit mind-boggling. Nothing short of that. Take care. Be on your guard. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions, and that is a hard lesson for us to learn. Ours is a culture in which very few people could ask John Stossel's question, "Who needs $100 million?" Because most people say, "I do." Be nice. Yeah, what if I had it? That would be great. But Jesus called his followers to forsake the security of material possessions. He called people to turn to God for their security, not to their own ability to accumulate possessions and lay up wealth for the future. Life is not to be valued or measured in terms of wealth or possessions. In verse 16, Jesus illustrates this point with this wonderful parable. And he tells the story of a rich man who is already rich, but now he enjoys a bumper crop. Jesus gives the farmer no credit for the crop. He merely says the land produced abundantly. Now he has a storage and surplus problem. He doesn't have a place to put all of the grain. And using creative storytelling, Jesus tells us, allows us to overhear what the man is thinking. The farmer debates with himself. "What should I do? For I have no place to store my crops. I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have ample good laid up for many, many years. Relax, eat, drink, and be merry.'" By the way, I thought that was Shakespeare, but it's not. It's the Bible, in case you are wondering. We find wonderful insight, though, in this little soliloquy. Notice the frequency of the possessive pronoun in his thoughts. My crops, my barns, my grain, my goods, and finally, my soul. And notice how many times he says the word, "I will." I will do this. I will pull down my barns. I will build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods, and I will say to my soul. See, here is a man who is self-made, sure of himself, and what he will do with his property. But maybe the most notable aspect of this little speech lies in the fact that he's talking to himself. There's nobody else around. A lot of us talk to ourselves when we're alone, and there's nothing wrong with that. But this man's flaw lies in the fact that he shut everybody out from his life and his thoughts, and there's no one for him to talk to, no one else in the story. He doesn't even talk to God. But in the end, God talks to him. So here we find this lonely, selfish man, preoccupied with his possessions. He's faced with a major decision. He takes no counsel from anybody. He doesn't pray about it. He doesn't think about it with anyone else. His only thought is that he can amass his wealth and hoard it all and relax and eat and drink and be merry. He doesn't even indicate that he's going to invite anyone else to be a part of this party. The thought of giving to persons in need never even crosses his mind. The thought of sharing his wealth or even investing in worthy projects never dawns on him. Greed has eaten away at his compassion, and he may have once had. And the greatest good that he can imagine is a life of his own pleasure. Now, you know, I don't play the lottery because I'm too cheap, but I don't have a moral problem with it. It's just, you know, don't go crazy. But I always ask people, what would you do if you won? Wouldn't it be great? And people, they have parties, and they'll sit around, they'll talk about what I do with it. And I love the ones that say, I would give to my church, like 10% would give to my church. This happened one time in a church in Atlanta. And the church had a big debate over what are they going to do with this. And are we going to keep this? The winnings of a lottery? I mean, that sounds like gambling money, doesn't it? And they asked me mine, and I think my phrase was, would you take it? And I used the word hell and yes and put them together. Hell yes. If God gives it to you, you better give it back to God, at least 10%. But that was just me. You know, it's not in the Bible. I looked. Not in the movie either, so it's not there. But people will often say, what will you do? Oh, I'll give it away. I'll share it. But the reality is when you go back and you look to see what's happened when people have this tremendous windfall, they don't do that. In fact, many times their lives just become a living hell. And so the winning of this tremendous material blessings without there being an underpinning of something that is larger than themselves ends in disaster. It happens over and over and over again. The rich man's future sounds uncomfortably like the one that most of us have when it comes to our retirement years. Now, don't get pinched, because that's most of us. I mean, aren't we literally doing the same thing, trying to sock away savings in 401ks so that one day you're able to relax, eat, drink, and be merry? I mean, however, the recent downturn in the market has eaten away at a lot of that. And I know there are a lot of people in our congregation who are a little bit nervous about what the next few years are going to hold. But those who do not worship their possessions have a different attitude about it. It's not easier, but it is a more balanced understanding of the beneficence of God, about the providence of God. You've been okay so far. You'll continue to be okay. This is just something that the market does. But for some people, they are so wrapped up in all of that that they are almost destroyed when they look at their stocks and say, I'm losing this much money a day. It's not good, because God calls that question into behavior. It calls into that behavior into question. And in our story, God interrupts the man's retirement plan saying, you fool, this very night your life is going to be demanded of you, and the things you've prepared, whose will they be? It is Jesus' not so gentle way of reminding us that we can't count on the future. We can't live in that future. You can only live in the now. And the important question is now, what gives our life meaning? Now. In Luke 9:25, he puts the matter this way. What does it profit them if they gain the whole world but lose or forfeit themselves? Martin Koppenhauer, a senior pastor of First Congregational Church in Burlington, Vermont, once saw a television program which David Frost, the British television personality, interviewed prominent people, public figures, and he said, I don't remember so much about the program or what was said or even who was interviewed, but I do remember the one question that Frost asked each person. The question was this: what would you like to have appear on your epitaph? Think about that for a second. He could have put the question this way: on the night that your soul is required of you, what would you want to have said about you? Because it really is kind of a brilliant question, because it leads the person to consider what is the most important thing about themselves. What is the most important thing to them? What are they living for? And it seemed to catch each of these guests off balance in their imagination in the sudden presence of their own deaths. And how would you answer that? How would you? In the popular book, Seven Habits of Effective People, Stephen Covey suggests this exercise. Think of yourself dying 5 years from now and write your obituary. What would you want it to say? Alfred Nobel was forced to do that. One morning in 1888, he got up to read the newspaper and he read the obituaries, and there he was, right there in the obituaries. Obviously, it was a mistake. One of the brothers had died, and a careless reporter used a pre-written obituary for him the wrong way, for Alfred the wrong way. But as he read it, Nobel was shocked and disturbed, because all the world was going to remember of him was that he invented dynamite. The merchant of death, they called him. He amassed a great fortune out of the explosives. And he hoped that his invention would be useful maybe to people and to nations. Yet he was reviewed as one who had dealt death in blood and war and done it for a profit. And at that moment, he resolved to change things and to show the world that he was more than that, to show the real purpose of his life. And so he revised his will so that all of his money would be dedicated to recognizing great creative achievements, with the highest award going to those who had done the most for world peace. The Nobel Prize was what came from that. And today that's what we associate with him, the Nobel Prize for Peace. I remember hearing a story of a young man with an older man. They were having a conversation about the future, and the young man said, "Well, you know, I'm going to learn a trade." And then the old man said, "Oh, I'll set up a business." And then, "Well, I think I'll make my fortune." And then, "Well, I suppose I'll grow old and retire and live on my money." And then, "Well, I suppose that someday I'll die." And then came the last question. It's kind of bleak, isn't it? Could even be sort of scary and cause a bit of anxiety to rise up within us. Is that all that life is about? Or is there something more? "Don't be afraid, little flock, for your Father has pleased to give you the kingdom." Our modern world seems to be built on anxiety. And we see it on the faces of people hurrying to work, cutting one another off in traffic, trying to put on their tie in their rearview mirror and fixing their hair. We see it even more as people travel home, tired but without having solved any of their problems. Faces are weary, puzzled, living higher goals for ourselves and each other. And then we worry all day, all year, about how we're going to reach those goals. And if we do reach them, will we set new ones? And if we don't, will we feel as if we failed? And if this is really how life is supposed to be lived? I mean, I hate to be so depressing. Jesus gives us the moral to his parable. "So it is with those who store up treasures for themselves, but are not rich towards God." In his popular book, The Seven Habits of Effective People, Covey suggests this exercise. I've mentioned it already. Think 5 years into the future. And what do you want to be said about you? Former President Bill Clinton was in a reflective mood at a conference about 25 years ago or so. And he was asked to be the speaker at a keynote speak and to explain some of his favorite things. And he talked about the Bucket movie. Do you all remember Bucket movie? Morgan Freeman was in it and Jack Nicholson was in it. And in the bucket, he said, "I have a bucket list and there is an A and there is a B. And the B list would be fine to do, but doesn't really amount to a hill of beans whether I get to it or not. I'd like to climb Mount Kilimanjaro before the snows melt. I'd like to run a marathon before I give out. There's lots of things I'd like to do, but it doesn't really matter whether I do them." He said the A list was far more important than his B list. "What I'd really like to do if I could have my wishes on the A list, I would like to live to see my own grandchildren grow up. I'd like to live to know that all the grandchildren of the world will have the chance in not too distant future to live their own dreams and not die before their time." And his bucket list reminded me of the contributions of another president, George Bush. Perhaps you remember that he jumped out of an airplane on his 80th birthday. Remember? Yeah, pretty impressive. That, however, was a B kind of activity. What he did, though, of course, besides being a good president, was to step up when the tsunamis hit in 2004 and to be a leader for the world for trying to help people that were devastated by that. And then there's the example of Jimmy Carter. We were talking earlier in the week about how many of us had met Jimmy Carter, and there's quite a few of us in this church. Many people disagree with his actions when he was a president, but very few people would argue that he has not been one of the best ex-presidents this country's ever had. And as an article in the Ledger Inquirer of Columbus, Georgia, did an interview with him, the reporter said, "What's on top of your agenda right now?" And he said this, "Well, the Carter Center is my work. That's where my wife and I both spend our life. We work there for 51 weeks a year. We have programs in 65 nations, 35 of them in Africa. Half our budget is in healthcare, and we negotiate peace agreements around the world. We have a very large agricultural project in Africa with 600,000 farms teaching local people how to grow their own food." And the reporter then asked, "Well, how would you characterize your work of the last 20 years? "That is what we have been our goals, and that's what we're driving for." And Carter said, "That what is driving me towards them is just a matter of gratification and enjoyment, leaving an interesting life, adventure, diverse experiences. I learned a lot in my governorship, in my campaign, in my presidency, but we also have learned at least as much, if not more, in the last 20 years, primarily about the plight and the needs of the poverty-stricken people of the world, who all too often, including now, we neglect or ignore." So which is the better epitaph? Which one is more like your what your epitaph will be? Because think about it. We have an opportunity today to make a change in the world. We have an opportunity throughout the week to make a change. And it will depend on the choices that you make in your world. Now, I have a 20-year-old in my house. So this all comes down, you know, the rubber hits the road really fast with that. Because they're in that part of their lives where they're trying to figure out what is important. And you know what's important to a 20-year-old? I mean, that we can talk about in church. Right. Is it world hunger? No. Is it trying to figure out how to feed people, how to clothe people, to people that are in prison? Is any of that part of it? Or is it the most greatest concern might be to, well, get a new car would be nice. Yeah. Get out on our own. Hang out with my friends. There's all those things. But, okay, now you're going to have to help me. Who is it here that has their child that just entered the Peace Corps? Was it you, Linda? Yes, right, your grandchild. So Babs's grandchild, granddaughter, who's been here to worship with us, could you tell us just a little bit about, how old is she?
She's 26.
She's 26. Go ahead and say it loud.
She's going to Uganda for 2 years with the Peace Corps. She will be teaching in a village somewhere in Uganda after some period of orientation. She's been waiting a long time. She had been assigned two plus years ago, to go elsewhere in Africa, and then COVID hit. So she's been waiting for a long time.
And how long did you say she'll be there?
2 years.
2 years. This is not unusual. You just don't hear about this. What do you hear about? The trash, you know, the people that all they care about is what they can get and how much they can amass and the world's richest and the world's stupidest, I think, sometimes. It's amazing. And then you have an illustration like that of a young woman. And there's young men all across the world, not just from the United States, who give of themselves, who've actually thought about their lives and what they're going to leave behind. Now, I don't know about you. When you were in your 20s, did you think like that? Because I sure didn't. But it's not too late. It's not too late to choose your best epitaph. So think about that. Will it be about your money? Or will it be about your life? Let us pray. Our Father, we are truly surrounded by goodness. goodness and generosity, people who are dedicated and dedicating their lives to something far greater. This rich fool in our parable today sounds like people that we know, and sometimes even sounds like us, and we don't like that. But when we hear that story, we realize that there is another way, and that way leads through you. He did not have you. He had himself. He did not have friends. He had himself. He did not have a greater perspective. All he had was himself. We are not like that here because we have each other. Help us as we reach out, discover the ministries and the ways that we can change this world for good and for God. We ask this because it is our epitaph. Serving God. Amen.